and give them something meaningful.
It's about intimacy across lines that society doesn't want crossed. And with a human being that everything in society wants you not to be present with, because there's power in that connection. Intimacy is this radical concept that when we can get there, either as allies across our lines that have been so inculcated from such an age, there is power to change the world with that. There's incredible power.
And that's it for this edition of Making Contact. You've been listening to excerpts from the documentary Mirrors of Privilege, Making Whiteness Visible. It was produced and directed by Dr. Shakti Butler in association with World Trust. We have much more about this film at our website, including information about the producers, participants, and World Trust. That's at radioproject.org, where you can also browse our archive of past shows, sign up for our weekly podcast, or make a difference by supporting our work. We'd like to know what this program made you think about. Please let us know. You can find contact information at our website or write us a review on iTunes. We're also on Facebook and on Twitter, where our handle is making_contact. The Making Contact team includes Lisa Rutman, Marie Che, RJ Lozada, Monica Lopez, Vera Tye Sculler, and Sabine Blazin. I'm Anita Johnson. Thanks for listening to Making Contact.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud sponsor of the People's Climate Movement March and Rally, Saturday, April 29th at noon, meeting at Dawson Park in North Portland. The People's Climate Movement March and Rally calls for racial, social, and economic justice as pathways to climate action. All individuals are invited to join to show solidarity. The gathering begins at noon, and speakers will begin at 12:30 p.m. The march starts at 1:30 p.m. and ends at 4 with tabling and cleanup. Again, that's the People's Climate Movement March and Rally, Saturday, April 29th at noon, meeting at Dawson Park at North Williams and North Stanton in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
You're listening to Voices for the Animals on your community radio, KBOO Portland.
The more compassion we have towards animals, the more compassion we're going to have towards other people.
If you can value them all, you really value yourself as well.
So even if you don't care about animals, the things we do that hurt animals end up hurting ourselves.
It's almost kind of a dominion type issue where we feel we need to control everything.
Dominion means stewardship, to take care of.
What would a cow think about satisfying our habit? The challenge lies with looking at suffering from the perspective of the person or individual suffering.
Welcome to Voices for the Animals. I'm your host, Deb Stedman, and my guest today is Colette Atkins, a senior attorney at the Center for Biological Diversity. Colette works in their Endangered Species Program, which focuses on combating exploitation and cruel treatment of rare animals. We'll be talking today about the war on wildlife that's being conducted by the U.S. Wildlife Services Agency. Colette, thank you for calling in today, all the way from Minneapolis.
Yes, well, thank you for having me.
Okay, great. Before we get into the nuts and bolts of today's discussion, can you tell us a little bit about your organization and what made you leave a private law practice to advocate for the animals instead?
Yes. Well, the Center for Biological Diversity is a national nonprofit organization focused on endangered species protection. And I specifically work on exploitation of rare wildlife, a lot of hunting and trapping and predator control type issues. And you're right, before I was at the center, and I've been here for just over 5 years now, I was in private practice. One of my pro bono clients was the Center for Biological Diversity, and I did work there, like trying to keep wolves on the list of endangered species in the Great Lakes, litigation that's still ongoing today. But when it came down to it, is the reason why I went to law school and really the value set that informs not only my career choice, but what I choose to eat and what I choose to drive and, you know, how I raise my kids. It really comes down to this strong value for animal life and wanting to be able to, you know, use the gifts that I've been given to try to advocate for them. And I thought I could do the best job of that by working with the Center for Biological Diversity.
Well, that's great. I wish there were more people like you out there. Now, let me ask you, the mission of the U.S. Wildlife Services, as stated on the USDA website, is to, quote, provide federal leadership and expertise to resolve wildlife conflicts, to allow people and wildlife to coexist. Based on your research and your own experience, is this an accurate description of the reality out in the field?
Well, the idea of coexisting with wildlife sure does sound like the ideal that we should be striving for. Unfortunately, what the HS Wildlife Services does in implementing that, I think, laudable goal really is more about killing wildlife and very infrequently trying to make sure that people and wildlife, you know, coexist together peacefully. They really should just be known as a wildlife killing agency. That's what they do. They kill wildlife to protect property, livestock. They have, you know, there's some important roles that they play, although I think they could do that through non-lethal methods. But for example, like birds in on airports that could cause a plane to crash, they're tasked with killing those animals. Although a lot of these problems, if we really wanted to coexist people and wildlife, that agency could focus on habitat modification or non-lethal deterrence methods.
Well, that's what I was going to ask you. Are they by law required to try non-lethal methods of control and mitigation before going to, you know, actually killing animals?
They are not required to try non-lethal methods first. And in fact, the way that their program works, it really incentivizes landowners to turn to lethal methods as a first resort. And this is an agency that's been in existence, you know, for decades, way back. They have their roots on predator extermination. You know, they wanted there to be no wolves, you know, no cougars left in the United States. They were tasked with eradicating these animals. And that mentality of just killing off wildlife to benefit humans still exists.
Yes, I know from way back when, at least 20 years ago, the name of the agency used to be Animal Damage Control, and then it was changed to the more, you know, the nicer sounding Wildlife Services, which is a little bit misleading.
That's right. Yeah, and confusing too, because the another agency, which actually does a lot of great work, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Services, is very different from Wildlife Services. One is Wildlife Services, which we're talking about today, that's under the Department of Agriculture and really deals with this wildlife killing. And then the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Services, they are tasked with preservation of endangered species, run a lot of national wildlife refuges, and that sort of thing.
Okay, well, about the killing, approximately how many animals are reported killed every year by the Wildlife Services? And which ones are most likely to be victimized?
Well, last year in 2016, 2.7 million animals were killed by this program.
Oh my gosh!
It's really heartbreaking. That includes over 76,000 coyotes, plus an unknown number of pups that die in the hundreds of destroyed dens. 21,000 beavers, nearly 4,000 foxes, hundreds of wolves, black bears, mountain lions, nearly 1,000 bobcats, more than 500 river otters, 15,000 prairie dogs, plus all the baby prairie dogs that are killed in 68,000 burrows that are fumigated or destroyed. they spend millions and millions of taxpayer dollars to kill millions of animals.
Now, of that total, can you talk a little bit about non-target animals? Because I know through my reading, I've heard that many other animals, including sometimes people's own pets, are caught up in these traps and poisons and so forth. Do we know how many non-target animals are killed and which ones are, you know, likely to, again, become victims?
Well, we don't know exactly. The one thing that's good about Wildlife Services is that they do have maintain a web page that that summarizes the number of animals that are killed, both intentionally and unintentionally. But what we know from media reports, interviews of former employees, that those numbers are vast underestimates of the numbers of animals that are actually killed, especially in terms of the unintentional deaths. Now, I mean, of course, there's a self-preservation aspect in here. They don't want to advertise the fact that they are killing things they aren't sent out to kill, especially when it's an endangered species, when it's someone's companion animal. What they reported last year in 2016 was that about 2,700 animals were unintentionally killed, including badgers, bears, bobcats, foxes, muskrats, otters, porcupines, raccoons, skunks, turtles, you know, like you said, family animals. The reason for this is that the methods that they use are indiscriminate killers. These, just like I said, these are methods that have been around for decades and decades. They're barbaric and outdated and not...
Yeah, we're going to talk about that in a little bit more detail in a little bit about those methods. But let me ask you, what activates the agency to into action? At whose behest and for whose benefit does Wildlife Services carry out these actions against animals?
Well, the primary... reason is to benefit agricultural interests, and that's both just farming, like field crops, and they kill lots of birds, lots and thousands and thousands of blackbirds, for example, and then for ranching interests, and that's where they kill primarily coyotes, but other predators as well. But then there are other reasons besides agricultural. Like I said, they have human health and safety concerns, like killing animals at airports. Sometimes, you know, there's some very strange ones in there that just shock me. Like, there was an instance where Wildlife Services was asked by a city to kill black vultures because they found them to just create an ominous feel for their town, you know. So, like, there's just a wide variety of reasons why they kill animals, and honestly, it doesn't take much of a reason.
You know, that makes me laugh because I actually went on the USDA Wildlife Services website, and they were listing the number of complaints about various animals, and there was recently, I guess, a complaint against a hummingbird. So, I don't know. I'm sorry. It just, I know this isn't a funny thing, but that just struck me as just so odd and so outrageous. Now, I also read that livestock operators claim that they lose over, approximately $130 million a year through predation. Do we know if those claims are valid at all?
You know, it's really hard to say, and that's one criticism of the program, is that there really has never been a rigorous cost-benefit analysis of the program. We know that nearly $130 million were spent on killing animals, and here you're quoting the data there that maybe that $100 million spent was to save 130-something million in livestock losses. But we really don't know. But the problem here is that you don't need to kill animals to protect livestock. There's alternative methods that are often far cheaper and more effective and protective of the environment and wildlife.
Do you want to talk about a few of those, please?
Sure. So let's just take the example of a rancher. You know, let's say someone who's out got cows giving birth and are concerned about their calves and their cows being hurt by wolves or coyotes, other predators. So just having human presence, the old-fashioned, cowboy, range riders, people that are out creating human presence around the animals deters predators. We know how shy, wolves are. For me, it would be a huge treat to be able to see one. And, of course, they scatter in human presence. Some common sense things to prevent the animals from being attracted there. So good animal husbandry. Too often, especially out west, where there's these vast acres of public land where the cows are just turned out, there'll be animals that die and are rotting. There's these bone piles that attract the animals right in.
So there's a lot more to be done than just to pick up the phone and call the feds to come in and eliminate wildlife. Colette, we're going to have to take a short break now, but we'll return in just a moment. We're back now, and you're listening to Voices for the Animals on KBOO Portland. We're talking about our government's war on wildlife with Colette Atkins, attorney and animal defender at the Center for Biological Diversity. Okay, Colette, you were just talking about various non-lethal methods of, good livestock management practices. But let's move on to talk about the actual methods used by the U.S. Wildlife Services in their secret culling of our native wildlife. In March of this year, a young male wolf in Oregon, known as OR-48, who was not being targeted, met a terrible death by a device called an M44. Can you describe this device and what it does?
Yes, M44s have been in the media lately, and I'm glad they are, because it's something that the public really should be outraged about. So this is a small little device. It just looks like a little sprinkler head or a tiny little pipe poking out of the ground. But what it does is when it's pulled upon and it'll be baited with kind of a goopy scent or sometimes even rotting meat. And when it's pulled upon by it's meant to target coyotes primarily, it shoots out sodium cyanide that causes the animal to suffer and die quite dramatically and quickly. Now, as you can imagine, that device is completely indiscriminate. Anything that comes and pulls upon the device will be shot with that cyanide. So, in Oregon, we lost that wolf, and that was a non-target. The agency wasn't out trying to kill wolves, but they put this device in occupied wolf habitat, and it's not surprising that a wolf would be attracted to it and died.
And wasn't there a case somewhere not too long ago where a little boy and his dog got mixed up with one of these M44s?
Yes, last month in two separate instances. There was one in Idaho with a boy and his dog. And the boy thought it was a sprinkler and pulled on it. The wind was blowing really strongly, and luckily it blew most of the cyanide away from the boy, but then it blew it right to the dog. And the dog died, and the boy is still suffering from severe headaches and, of course, the trauma of watching his dog die right before him.
Terrible.
And then in Wyoming, there was a family that was out, and there was actually two dogs from two separate families. They're out kind of rock climbing and looking for shed antlers on public land there, and two of the dogs died from M44s. And the thing is, the people don't know what's happening to their animals. So In both instances, the people like grab their dogs and try to resuscitate them. A lot of them trying to wash them down, and then the people are completely exposed to cyanide, having no idea that there would be this cyanide bomb set in a place where people and animals could be affected.
Oh, that sounds really dangerous. And you mentioned before about whole families of wolves being gassed in their own dens.
Yeah, it's really awful. This agency, as long as the animals aren't protected under the Endangered Species Act, and certainly in lots of parts of the country now, wolves have no federal protection. If a county, if an individual landowner asks the feds, or through the county asks the feds to come out, they can put out M44s, they can put out leg hold traps and snares, they can gas dens, just putting like a fumigant in the den. So a lot of the animals die, and it's really quite heartbreaking.
And I know up in Alaska, one of the preferred methods, which I guess is going to be legal again, is aerial shooting.
Well, I don't believe that aerial shooting of wolves is actually going to be allowed in Alaska, but there was a recent rule that the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service passed that would prohibit several very aggressive and cruel predator hunting techniques on wildlife refuges, and one of those did include shooting bears by plane, snaring and trapping bears, shooting like grizzly bears even over bait, and again killing wolves and their pups in dens.
Oh boy. And that's not even the entire list. I know that pesticides and other controlled substances are sometimes used, and as you were saying, scents and baits and attractants and lure crops. Would you say that these methods are discriminating? In other words, are they appropriate for that particular animal or species, or are they just sort of out there and whoever comes along is the hapless victim?
Well, it depends a lot on the particular device and where it's placed. So, there's one, for example, called a livestock protection collar. Where they put compound 1080, which is a very toxic chemical, but they strap these bladders of this poison to sheep. And so that is actually quite targeted in the fact that, the coyote or the wolf has to actually be attacking the sheep to be poisoned. But then even with that, then what happens is then the coyote goes off and dies. And then a condor or an eagle or a hawk or ravens come and feed upon that coyote, and then more animals die. So even the most seemingly targeted device still can result in non-target deaths, and is really just more evidence why we really should be shifting our focus to non-lethal and preventative measures.
Well, I totally agree. And from the sound of it, the U.S. Wildlife Services is an agency that's kind of on a rampage against large numbers of many types of animals. So what is your organization or other groups doing to stop or at least slow down the killing?
Well, I'm leading the Center's Campaign Against Wildlife Services. We've got lots of staff members that work on this campaign. We bring litigation. We've done petitions for rulemaking, trying to get the Wildlife Services to have rules that govern what type of methods that they can rely upon.
Yeah, I understand they're one of the few agencies that either doesn't have a regulatory code or that it's very sparse.
Yeah, they really don't. And that's part of the reason why they really can get away with doing so many awful things, because there really is very few legal limits on what they can do. Let me tell you just about a couple of pieces of very recent litigation.
Oh, so, good. Yeah.
Yeah, just last week, the Center, along with a handful of partner organizations, we filed a lawsuit trying to get at those M44s that killed that wolf and those dogs recently. So what we're hoping there is that there would be reasonable mitigation measures that would be required whenever an M44 is used, like not allowing them to be used in endangered species habitats. But what we really want is a ban on M44s. But in the meantime, we're just trying to use the legal tools we have. And in that lawsuit, we were using the Endangered Species Act to at least prohibit the use of these devices where endangered wildlife could be killed. And then just yesterday, along with Wild Earth Guardians, the center filed a lawsuit against the Wildlife Services Program in Colorado, challenging the entire state's program for failing to consider the environmental impacts, the deaths of non-targets, the ecological impact of killing predators. And what's particularly problematic about the Colorado program is that they specifically target predators to increase the number of ungulates, like deer, for hunters. So they're not just killing predators to protect agricultural interests, but they're just trying to make there be more deer out there for hunters.
Yes, for hunters. And then also, I understand that state wildlife departments are, well, sort of benefit vicariously, because the more deer that are out there, the more hunting licenses that are sold, and their salaries are, the staff salaries and their budgets come from, you know, a good part from the revenues from these licenses.
Yes, that's a problem that is just widespread across wildlife management agencies, you know, every state in the United States, really. They've got such a focus on game animals because they get that money from hunter licenses, but it's really hard to get them to base their policies on broader ecological values rather than just satisfying the interests of a minority of hunters in the state.
Yeah. Now, I know, you know, there are some efforts to protect data sets, and that your agency, your organization, has some publications such as Making Way for Wolf Recovery that are educating the public. But, you know, it looks like we're going to be up against a real battle with the Trump administration. And so far, in terms of the impact on animals, have you what have we seen from the new administration in Washington?
Well, we talked just briefly about that rule in Alaska that would have prohibited those very awful predator killing methods, like the killing of wolves and bears in their dens. So the Trump administration and the, you know, the Republican-controlled Congress, one of the first things they did this year in February, and then signed by Trump in late March, they rescinded that good Obama administration rule, which does open up those lands to those awful predator control practices. But it's not just wildlife. You know, we've seen these rollbacks of so many science-based programs, the EPA, for example. It's really discouraging and frustrating, and we really need people more than ever to prepare, you know, to resist, to hit the streets for their local marches, and to write and call their congresspersons and speak out against this damaging agenda.
Well, great. And your agency has put together something called a Trump Action Toolkit?
Yeah, that's right. Folks can just Google Trump Action Toolkit, and you'll see one that comes up there by the from the Center for Biological Diversity, and it gives ideas of things that you know, regular folks can do to try to resist the Trump agenda. You know, attending town hall meetings, volunteering at Earth Day celebrations, calling congresspersons, and opposing attacks on the Endangered Species Act. You know, there's just so many things that we can do, but it really comes down to just speaking up for wildlife and other causes that you care about.
Okay, and for the activists out there, your website is www.biologicaldiversity.org, and your Twitter is #Earth2Trump, okay, Earth to Trump. Any other way that activists out there can help?
You know, one thing that I really have done ever since I was in high school is just to write letters to editor. If you see a piece out there that is portraying values towards wildlife that you disagree with, just speak up. I think this really is a long-term change in public values that's needed. So just speaking up, I think, makes a big difference.
Okay, great. It looks like we're out of time now. Thank you so much, Colette, for being our guest today. We've been talking We've been talking with Colette Atkins, senior attorney at the Center for Biological Diversity, about the War on Wildlife by the U.S. Wildlife Services Agency. But before we sign off today, I want to make a special announcement about an upcoming event to benefit elephants. The Spring Fling Bake Sale and Raffle, sponsored by Free the Oregon Zoo Elephants, will be held on Saturday, May 6th from 11 a.m. to 4 p.m. at the Cherokee Rose Inn, located at 2924 Southeast Alder in Portland. All proceeds will go to FOES and to support Prince the Elephant, who is happily retired at the Paws Sanctuary. You can get more information on the Free Oregon Zoo Elephants Facebook page. This is Dab Stedman thanking all of you for listening to Voices for the Animals. To hear a podcast of any of our programs, just go online to kboo.fm and click on Audio, then Programs. And please plan to tune in again on the fourth Monday of next month. Until then, remember that you too can be a voice for the animals.
Good afternoon. It is just noontime, and you are tuned in to KBOO Portland. Thank you, all you loyal members out there, for continuing to support us. And if you're not a member, you can go to kboo.fm and click on Donate. Please stay tuned now, for I think we're going to have noon news, and followed by Noontime Jamboree.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Pete Seeger Tribute and Sing-Along happening Sunday, April 30th at 6:30 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater in Portland. At this celebration